Plenty of voice and chatbot interactions involve a screen. And that means the interaction might include an avatar, a visual representation of the character. It could be as simple as a 2D smiling face in a chatbot window, an animated non-human icon, remember Clippy, Microsoft's paperclip-bodied helper, or a near-photographic avatar, like a photorealistic video game character. To begin, challenge yourself as to whether or not you need a visual representation of a personality at all. Even with the affordance of a screen, an avatar isn't necessary. People have interactions where they don't see their speaking partner on a daily basis. When you pick up the phone, you don't see who's on the other end of the line, and that fact doesn't hinder your ability to communicate. The same is true for chat interactions. And look at Alexa and Siri and Google Assistant, all faceless. It's tempting to use a visual representation. After all, it's a great branding opportunity. And gut instinct might tell you that it will feel more personal and human-centered if you can see your speaking partner. You might even say that having a visual representation gives you a greater opportunity to portray emotion through facial expressions, and this could create deeper connections with users. Okay, but the same minefields that exist with personality development extend to visual representations. In other words, bias can emerge strongly in visuals too. Even if your team successfully avoided bias while creating the on-paper version of the personality, the danger gets reintroduced with a visual character. Second, if your avatar is approaching a high-fidelity human appearance, it can soon enter the uncanny valley, the zone where a figure looks almost human-like but not quite, and thus comes across as eerie or disturbing. Third, emotions can be conveyed with symbols or abstract images. Planned Parenthood's Rue has a simple, shape-based representation that looks friendly and anthropomorphic, while clearly remaining a thing, not a person. I remember vividly the moment I found out that the universe might end at any second. I was sitting on Professor Finney's living room floor with the rest of my undergraduate astronomy class for our weekly dessert night, while the professor sat on a chair with his 3-year-old daughter on his lap. He explained that the sudden space-stretching expansion of the early universe, cosmic inflation, was still such a mystery that we don't have any idea why it started or why it ended. And we have no way of saying that it won't happen again, right now. No assurance existed to tell us that a rapid, unsurvivable rending of space couldn't start right then, in that living room, while we innocently ate our cookies and drank our tea. I felt completely blindsided, as if I could no longer trust the solidity of the floor beneath me. Forever etched into my brain is the image of that little child sitting there, fidgeting obliviously in a suddenly unstable cosmos, while the professor gave a little smirk and moved on to another topic. Now that I'm an established scientist, I understand that smirk. It can be morbidly fascinating to ponder processes so powerful and unstoppable, yet precisely mathematically describable. The possible futures of our cosmos have been delineated, calculated, and weighted by likelihood based on the best available data. We may not know for certain if a violent new cosmic inflation could occur right now, but if it does, we have the equations ready. In a way, this is a deeply affirming thought. Even though we puny, helpless humans have no way of being able to affect or effect an end to the cosmos, we can begin to at least understand it. In the end, the public will draw its own conclusions when political leaders reveal through their delivery that they are not in command of their own messages. In Gerald Ford's case, his verbal stumbling, combined with his pardon of Richard Nixon, nearly destroyed his presidency. The news media presented Ford's problems with delivery as a metaphor for lack of intelligence. Jules Whitcover reports, "Ford's inability to pronounce difficult words, and some not so difficult, was immediately seized upon as a measure of his brain power. In a speech in Atlanta in early February 1975, he stumbled an inordinate number of times in a speech on his energy proposals before getting out the word geothermal correctly. A tape of the speech became an overnight box office hit in the White House press room." When Ford gave a campaign speech in Kansas making reference to the Wizard of Oz, reporters composed the following ditty based on the song of the Scarecrow. I could while away the hours reflecting on my powers as we go down the drain. I could spend like Rockefeller, I could talk like Walter Heller if I only had a brain. In response, White House aides presented the speechwriters with lists of words that were not to appear in presidential speeches. Difficult locutions were to be avoided. But until the summer of 1976, no one discovered the two strategies that would salvage Ford's rhetorical record. The first was rehearsing speeches, and the second was creating a sense of style. As this chapter has shown, Ford's bicentennial speeches, and particularly his acceptance address, achieved those ends. Ford recovered from a 33-point deficit in the polls to lose by only 500,000 votes in the 1976 presidential election.